So, and don't forget your costume. I'm still in the process of preparing what I'm going to be doing. And so that's going to be it for this edition of The Wrecking Hours. For the next couple of weeks, we will be doing nothing but Monster Rock and Voodoo Billy for The Wrecking Hours. Two solid hours next week, and then two solid hours the day before Halloween for your listening pleasure. If you want to hear all of the fantastic Halloween music from the past 60 years of rock and roll history, be sure to tune in for the annual Halloween extravaganza here on the radio for Wrecking Hours. And if you've heard it from years past, you know that it is the biggest celebration for psychobilly music on the radio and on the Wrecking Hours each year. I'm going to leave you now with the Flanders doing their tune Killer.
This is WHFR, Dearborn.
Disclaimer, this show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our board of trustees, or students.
Thank you for listening to Philosophy Talk's free weekly download.
You can do your part for intelligent, reflective media by making a tax-deductible contribution to Philosophy Talk.
We really do rely on your support. Any contribution, big or small, will help us stay on the air and online.
And donating is very simple. Just visit our website at philosophytalk.org and click the donate link.
Thank you for supporting Philosophy Talk, and thank you for thinking.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Today, procrastination.
It's a topic we've been putting off for quite a while.
Ha ha ha. That's a pretty obvious one, John. Now, John, everyone who knows you realizes that you are actually an expert practitioner of the procrastinating arts, and also that you've written a series of lovely essays on the topic.
Why, thank you, Ken. I certainly have. And my essay, Structured Procrastination, I think is the most read thing I've ever written. By the way, listeners can find it at structuredprocrastination.com.
So that makes you an expert on procrastination, both from an experiential and from a theoretical point of view.
Not really, Ken. My essay is a very short, somewhat tongue-in-cheek essay that is designed to make procrastinators feel better about themselves. I'm really good at that. But there are real experts on procrastination. One of the finest, Timothy Pitchell, who's director of the Procrastination Research Group at Carleton University, will join us in a bit. Now, he's a psychologist who's done research on why we procrastinate and also what the best methods are for dealing with it.
You know, he's a psychologist, and we're philosophers, so that leads to the question, why is procrastination a philosophical issue or problem?
Well, since the time of the Greeks, philosophers, at least some of them, have been puzzled by how we decide that something is the best thing to do, and then we don't do it. And procrastination is an example of that. For example, I decide the best thing to do, all things considered, is to get up from the couch, go to my desk, and grade some term papers. But instead of doing that, I lie on the couch and watch a rerun of Cheers for the fourth time.
But that's just laziness. Is there really a philosophical problem about laziness, what laziness is?
Well, maybe I finally get up, but instead of grading the papers, I start cleaning up the kitchen. Then I move on to cleaning up the garage. I'm not being lazy. I'm just not doing what I've decided it's best for me to do. That's procrastination, not laziness.
Well, okay, so procrastination isn't laziness, at least not mere laziness, but it is a form of irrationality, I think. And is that so mysterious? People are irrational in lots of ways, and in some ways, thank goodness, because without irrationality, we philosophers wouldn't have much work to do.
Well, but if so, it's a very peculiar form of irrationality. Let me give you an analogy. Suppose you're multiplying 7 times 5 and adding 10. So you carefully figure out 7 times 5 is 35, add 10, and you have 45. And then you write down 55.
Well, but maybe that's just a slip of a pen. You don't really realize what you're doing.
Well, it wouldn't be mysterious if it was a slip of the pen, but suppose you're very aware that the right answer is 45. It's the best answer to write down, but you intentionally, purposefully, deliberately, and carefully write down 55. That's peculiar, right?
Very peculiar. Very, very peculiar.
Well, procrastination seems a little bit like that. You figure out what's best to do, most important to do, the rational thing to do, the right answer to the question, what should I be doing? And then you do something else.
Well, that certainly is puzzling. It's very puzzling. People call that clear-eyed procrastination. You're looking the best in the eye, right in the face, and you do the not best. And that's really puzzling. Now, to really be puzzled by that, you need a certain picture of the will, that is, of how we decide what to do. It's like what you say, kind of transposed to the will. The picture is that deliberating is like figuring out the answer to a problem. The problem, in this case, of what to do. And acting is just drawing the conclusion, like writing down the answer in your analogy. If that was the right picture, then procrastination and other forms of what philosophers like to call weakness of the will would be downright mysterious. Downright mysterious.
Exactly. But now, do you have another picture?
Well, the phrase weakness of the will maybe suggests another picture, a kind of Humean picture. Look, this picture distinguishes between the job of reason and the job of the will. The job of reason is to figure out the best thing to do. You know, but figuring out the best thing to do isn't wanting to do it, not automatically, not ipso facto. And that's what the will has to do. The will has to make you want to do. what you figured out is best to do. But, you know, unfortunately, the will doesn't always get you all the way to wanting to do this thing. That's what weakness of the will is. It's when you can't bring yourself to want to do what you figured out is what's best to do. And in procrastinators like you, that happens a lot. And in, you know, people like me, that happens too, but perhaps not as often.
Well, philosophers like you and I are pretty good at spitting out theories, but psychologists have to actually put them to the test. And when our guest Timothy Pitchell joins us in a bit, he'll help us choose between our rather half-baked ideas or more likely suggest something better.
But first, our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Ash, hits the streets to find the procrastinator is among us. She files this report.
Everyone procrastinates. The waitress who wants to become a student.
I'm procrastinating going back to school, you know, because of lack of funds.
The student who wants to finish school and start a career.
It's more long-term things that I'm procrastinating, which is applying for jobs or doing grad school research and stuff like that.
And the guy with three jobs already.
Like, I'm still attempting to do lots of stuff in my life when a lot of them I know might not ever be able to get done.
Yes, we all procrastinate.
I procrastinate all the time about housework. And I need to fix my brakes on my bike.
I put off doing most things, from laundry to writing papers and studying for exams. It's a mentality, really. It's a lifestyle.
I'm procrastinating a 10-by-7-foot drawing of an inverted person.
But why do we put off even the simplest tasks?
Sometimes you just don't feel like you want to do the work, and other times there are more exciting things around.
Sometimes it's because I feel like I'll do a better job later when I'm more like focused, and I never really feel that focused.
You find a lot of little things that you can do before having to complete anything else. So usually you can keep yourself busy procrastinating.
Some people are hard on themselves when they procrastinate, feel stressed, on edge, or even guilty.
Anxiety is one. I think that's like the biggest one. And that goes with the reason as to why I am procrastinating certain things and the effects of procrastinating as well. So it's kind of like this endless cycle that I'm kind of fueling and feeling the repercussions of.
Anxiety would definitely be up there. But it's exciting at the same time, too, to have to just kind of work really hard to come up with a solid product, even though you don't have that much time left.
Still, others are relatively unfazed by procrastination and claim they prefer to work under the stress of a tight deadline.
Sometimes I actually do it on purpose because I feel like I work better under pressure, and a lot of times it does work out. When I have that pressure, then I actually do a pretty good job.
But most would agree, I might have done a better job on that paper, midterm, job application if I had just started sooner.
Once I start, the anxiety kicks in, and it's a lot of, I wish I would have started earlier. I always think I could have done a better job if I started earlier, but while I'm procrastinating, I think I'll just be really effective once I actually start. That's what I tell myself.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Ash.
I'm John Perry, and with me is Ken Taylor.
And our guest is Timothy Pitchell. He's a professor of psychology from Carleton University. He's director of the Procrastination Research Group there and author of The Procrastinator's Digest, a concise guide to solving the procrastination puzzle. Tim, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks, Ken. Hi, John.
Hello, Tim. It's nice to talk to you again.
Now,
I want you to tell us briefly, how did you get interested in procrastination? Were you dealing with your own problem, or were you trying to figure out how to get the irritating procrastinators around you to mend their ways?
Neither of the above. I was studying goal pursuit and how we can understand people from their pursuit of goals. I was interviewing doctoral students, very accomplished people. I remember one student had two masters and a law degree studying for a PhD in political science, and she complained about her procrastination. So I went away from studying the goals we were pursuing successfully to studying this breakdown in volitional action that we commonly call procrastination.
Well, now, as a psychologist, you do experiments, you do studies, you do research, and you have to have a working definition, or maybe some working definitions, of procrastination. Could you share those with us?
Sure I can. I just loved your intro. I think, you know, I've been speaking to a lot of philosophers lately, but I'll tell you that all procrastination is delay, but not all delay is procrastination. It's one flavor of delay, and it has no virtue. It has no redeeming quality, and I think that's important to stress, that it's a voluntary delay of an intended action, even though one knows that you'll probably be worse off because of the delay. So it is this one flavor of delay that is nothing standing in the way from you working. You know you ought to be. It has that notion of acrasia that you and Ken were kind of trotting around earlier, that we know what we ought to do and we choose not to, even though we know this would probably bite us in the end. So that's the working definition.
Acrasia is a fancy term for what Ken and I call weakness of the will, right?
Right, but you know, it's funny that you'd invite me on the show now, because just recently I've been talking to Mark White at City University of New York, Sarah Stroud at McGill University, Joel Anderson at University of Utrecht, all philosophers, and there's a lot of debate about whether or not we can call procrastination weakness of will in the classic sense of acrasia, or even what Holton and McIntyre call weakness of will. Although I'll tell you, I believe procrastination is weakness of
will. Okay, but I just want to focus on something you said just to underline it. So not all forms of delay, though, are procrastination. And you say you want to reserve procrastination for a kind of vicious, non-virtuous kind of delay. Here's an example of what I mean. I assume I'm writing this book on reference that I've been writing for a long time, and it's not finished because I have all these immediate demands on me, right? Mm-hmm. And it actually frustrates me that I can't spend more time on this long-term thing, because there are all these things that pop up and need addressing now. You wouldn't say I'm procrastinating writing my book, right? And what's the difference between my not being able to get my book finished, which is a lovely book, which I love writing, because I'm doing all these other things that intervene?
Well, there's a lot of shades of gray in there, but on the surface, I'd say no, if all these things are true. But, you know, humans are very good at rationalizing away cognitive dissonance, and so sometimes we make excuses for delay by being even busy with other tasks. So on the surface, though, I'd say no. If other things, more important things come up, it is just an intention update. It's delay. It's not procrastination.
When you say more important, I actually regard the book as the most important thing I work on. But you know, the letter to the dean, the students' papers, the course to be taught, the script for philosophy talk, the baseball game I have to referee, those mm-hmm. all... I mean, does that make me a procrastinator or not? I just want to...
My vote is yes, let's hear what Timothy says.
Well, it depends. Importance carries a lot of other connotations, including the temporal notions of urgency. So, you know, we can say it's more personally important to you to do the book. There are other things that become important because they're more, in a temporal sense, closer, and they need to be done. So I think we got to watch. We just don't define terms badly. But I don't think you're necessarily procrastinating, no.
Timothy.
In fact, I don't think some of the examples were. You know, the student interviews weren't all procrastination. Some of them were simply delay. I prefer sometimes to work later.
So before we go to break, let me give you one final challenge. You said procrastination has no redeeming value. Mm-hmm. But haven't you ever procrastinated something and then found out it was something you really didn't need to do and you were better off? Procrastination saved you from a lot of work you didn't need to do?
Yes, and when those moments happen, we hang on to them so dearly to justify every other time we want to give in to feel good. So sure, we've all been there, but it doesn't make it right.
So tell me, though, just so we get a parade example before we go to the break, what's the parade example of procrastination? No ifs, ands, or buts. Because you said some of those students who said, I work better at the last minute, that's not procrastination. But what's the parade example of procrastination?
Oh, I wouldn't say that. In fact, I've done research deliberately on that to see if there's truly something called the arousal procrastinator. We don't find evidence of that at all.
So tell me the parade example.
Parade example, giving in to feel good. I say that Sunday at 10:15, I will be working on Project X, and 10:15 comes and said, I don't feel like it, and you go and do something else instead, even though your intention hasn't changed in terms of what you ought to be doing. That's the crucial thing. That's why it goes to that old notion of acrasia that both of you were bouncing around. I know what I ought to be doing, and I'm not doing it.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're discussing procrastination with Timothy Pitchell, author of The Procrastinator's Digest.
We know what procrastinators do or don't do, but why? Why do we put off until tomorrow what we should be doing today? What are the different patterns of procrastination? We'll explore that in our next segment.
Patterns of Procrastination, when Philosophy Talk continues. Just die here and wait my turn.
Procrastinators like me often wait our turn. It's easier to wait your turn. It's easier to wait for the deadline. Actually, a little beyond the deadline before you get started on something. rather than getting your act together and doing what's best like Ken. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk. Do you procrastinate? Do procrastinators drive you crazy? Has procrastination ever saved you from doing a job that turned out to be unnecessary or ill-considered?
Our guest is Timothy Pitchell from Carleton University, author of The Procrastinator's Digest.
So, Tim, we want to get into why people procrastinate in this segment. Now, John, on his website, thestructuredprocrastination.com, claims that procrastinators are often perfectionists, that they put off doing a task so at the last minute they can give themselves an excuse for doing an imperfect job. So, like, they know they're going to be imperfect or they feel they're going to be imperfect, and instead of taking it up right away and being imperfect, they wait, and then they say, see, I could have done better. Is he right about that? Is that a good hypothesis or not?
Oh, it's a good hypothesis. There's a few flavors of perfectionists identified by psychologists. One of them, maladaptive. It's socially prescribed perfectionists. So there's some people who just do a good job for themselves. Gord Flett at York University calls these self-oriented perfectionists. They don't tend to procrastinate, but if it's a socially prescribed perfectionism, you're trying to live up to other people's expectations, you don't feel you can do that, yeah, there's a tendency to put off, because now what you've created is a very aversive situation, and task aversiveness, the number one reason we procrastinate. So I'm in agreement with John. Some procrastination is caused by this maladaptive form of perfectionism.
Well, what are the other basic patterns that lead to procrastination?
Well, I think if we want to talk about most people, it has to do with what Diane Tice and Ellen Breslowski has written about, giving in to feel good. We focus so much on short-term mood repair. I said a moment ago that task aversiveness is crucial, that we don't want to do the task for whatever reason. It irritates us. It's boring. And so what we do is we want to do the short-term mood repair. I'll do what I want that makes me feel good now, and then it comes back to bite us. And so across all people, that's what we're up to.
I love that phrase, short-term mood repair. That sounds like something I can use. Next time my wife says, time to empty the trash, I'll say, well, I've got some short-term mood repair that I've got to do right now.
So wait a minute. So this makes it sound like, I mean, both of you guys make it sound like we procrastinate at things that we don't really, what are the things about which, over which we procrastinate? The things we don't really want to do? Onerous task? I mean, if it was a pleasant task, then would we procrastinate about it? Or is it always the onerous task that we don't really, some part of us is resisting doing this thing?
That's no doubt true. And sometimes, you know, we have, in our opening comments, we had a simple picture of reason. Reason, you look at everything you have to do, you figure out what's best. Well, what's best given what? Well, given what you value, what you have to do, what your needs are. But I think there's many levels of reason, and sometimes our unconscious reason has got different priorities than our conscious reason.
Tim, what do you think? I mean, what are the kinds of things that we're subject to procrastinate about? Is it just anything we're subject to procrastinate about?
Some of our earliest research showed that it's always things we find aversive, but we find aversive as a moving target. If it's just at the early planning stages of a project, it's the things that we find that lack personal meaning. But when it gets to the action phase of a project, the things we find aversive are things that are structured poorly, that we don't know how to do. So by and large, those are the things we procrastinate on. But there's other things in life where we say, if you listen to those interviews with the student, I'm procrastinating going back to school. And sometimes those are because they're falsely internalized goals. They're not really goals at all. They're not even your intentions. They're not you. You think you should be doing them, and it's a whole different level of ought.
Can one procrastinate out of fear at something that one really would like to do and really would be good to have done, and you're fully invested? So take me back to my book. Suppose I think I'm just not going to live this. I guess maybe this is the perfectionist thing. Mm. Suppose I think I just might not live up to the high standards I set myself. So I dither around and dither around out of fear. It's a kind of not unacknowledged fear of. So it's not, that's not something I'm averse to. I may be averse to the failure, but I'm not averse to actually writing the book.
No, in fact, that irrational fear is something clinical psychologists focus on a lot, and then that short-term mood repair comes in again, because you don't recognize it. It's quite unconscious, but you get looking at the book, and then you have these experiences of fear, and then you do something else to alleviate that, and it's very rewarding. Behaviorists at the same time would say, well, that's negative reinforcement at its best. You left the task, the fear goes away, and la-la, you're feeling better again. So certainly fear can play a role, but not for everyone. I love the work of Paul Tillich for that reason and his notion of the courage to be. I mean, that I think that in a profound way that procrastination represents an existential issue of getting on with life, and that takes courage.
Oh, I used to love Paul Tillich. I used to think I could be a Christian because I was ultimately committed to something or other. But then I found out that no one else was willing to call me a Christian just for that. But we digress. We got some insightful email from Gregory Slater. He says, procrastination can result from cognitive dissonance between how much we want to do and how much we can actually do in a given space of time. The refusal to resolve this issue makes our expectations incompatible with the time available, and that results in procrastination. How does that strike you?
Wow, it's an interesting theory. I do think we find a lot of evidence for the planning fallacy and overly optimistic bias towards thinking we can get more done in available time. But we don't usually find that that's related to procrastination. In fact, procrastinators know themselves very well. Research we've done on the planning fallacy shows they understand they're going to work later and work less. So I'm not convinced about that, but I do agree with the writer of the email in terms of cognitive dissonance. Cognitive dissonance looms large. In fact, the people who say, oh, I work better under pressure, I'll leave it till the night before. That night before, we've done research like this too, where we actually contact people. They're not spontaneously saying, I'm glad I waited till the last minute. I work so much better this way. And it was the dissonance reduction earlier in the week. So we're very good at that, and I think cognitive dissonance plays a big role in procrastination.
So even though the planning fallacy isn't the same as procrastination, a person like myself could be subject to both, right?
Absolutely. We're all subject to that to some extent, these optimistic biases, and they come into play.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about procrastination with Timothy Pitchell, one of the world's leading researchers on this topic. We've got a caller, Sheila from San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi there. Thank you. How would the opposite of procrastination be obsessive compulsion? For instance, are there some people who just have to do this, that, and the other, and so many things?
So you're wondering, Sheila, about people who are obsessively busy. She's looking at it maybe from the procrastinator's point of view. She's saying, look, overactivity is a vice, too. What do you think about that,
and
Timothy?
I think that lots of times we want to put those two poles against one another to say that I don't want to end up that way. But you know, even Viktor Frankl, who led quite an interesting life in terms of the meaning things he wrote about, when he wrote his own autobiography, said, I do the other things first so that I have time left in my life for important things. It doesn't mean we become compulsive. It just means that we do things in a timely way so that we can actually be more spontaneous. For example, if I procrastinate a task from work and it comes into my evening now and the kids say, let's go do such and such, I say, oh, I can't, I got to work on this report. Well, in fact, what I've become is less spontaneous and less able to do things. In fact, you can even become more compulsive in some ways. A printer breaks down and it becomes a national emergency because you put things off to the last minute. So I don't think we need to put those in polar opposition.
Michael from Oakland's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Michael.
Yes, hi, thank you. Wouldn't it be possible to characterize at least some of procrastination as lingering doubts or misgivings about what you have concluded, and which would require more rational thinking, and so in some ways is actually a form of rationality rather than irrationality?
Michael, thanks for the question. I love the question. Tim, I often wonder whether procrastination doesn't get a bad name for just the reason Michael says, because sometimes the procrastination is the voice of your resisting self saying, you don't really want to do this. You judge it's best, but there's a voice inside you saying, you don't really want this, do you? I mean, what do you think about that? You said it's always, you know.
Oh, boy, that's a tough thing to answer quickly, because I think it gets into something like Holton and McIntyre's notion of procrastination only being a weakness of will at the implementation phase. But I think we can get things like anemic intentions, and it's at the intention formation stage that's occurring. Like you haven't even formed a strong intention or a resolution to do that which you're going to do. And I want to reserve procrastination for the individual who has made an intention, knows that they ought to do it, it's in their best interest, and then there's this intention action gap. Certainly there's going to be all sorts of potential goals and intentions in our lives that we have misgivings about, and then we want to label it with one word, procrastination, and I think that it fails for that reason.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about procrastination with Timothy Pitchell from Carleton University, author of The Procrastinator's Digest. We've got a caller, Kathy from Chicago. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, all the way from Chicago, Kathy.
Thank you.
So what's your comment or question?
Well, I was thinking, yes, I procrastinate for things I don't want to do, but I also procrastinate about things that I'm very anxious about. I want to do them. They're a real goal, but they're very important to me, and I get very anxious. You were talking about it earlier, the fear. But for me, procrastination leads, it's because of anxiety, and the only thing that will break me of that anxiety is panic. It's sort of like rock, paper, scissors of emotion. Panic trumps anxiety. So if I get to the panic stage, I'm not anxious anymore. I'm working like a fiend and getting it done.
So, Tim, what do you think? What are you going to say to Kathy here?
I think that's a beautiful description of where a lot of us do work at the last minute, in fact. But that doesn't make it a good thing. I think that you've hit, when you started, you said, yes, I have this anxiety. So let's start there. I do think that the procrastination is an emotional process, not the rational process we want to make it out to be in terms of the utility of an action or not. That if you could work on the anxiety end of things, you might be able to get into what Csikszentmihalyi calls a state of flow more voluntarily, as opposed to waiting for the trump card of panic.
But, Tim, given the anxiety, isn't panic a good engineering response? You know, maybe you could go and re-engineer Kathy. Kathy, maybe you want some re-engineering. But given that she's not going to be re-engineered, isn't the panic mode a kind of rational response to that other design limitation?
It's a good response. I don't want to use the word rational, but I think it's a great response. It works. Absolutely, it works. And I think that's why I loved her rock, paper, scissors. It trumps it, and it works for her, and I think a lot of us get there. Does it make that our desired state? Not necessarily. Do I want to re-engineer her? No, but we're always in a process of becoming.
So, Kathy,
and I think that she could look for her change. Yeah.
So, Kathy, how do you feel about it? Are you going to go out and re-engineer yourself, or are you going to stick with panic?
I would love to re-engineer myself. But in the meantime, I guess I'll have to use panic.
Okay, thanks for the call. John, you got some emails.
Yeah, we got some emails. Now, here's an email from Richard Gelbart. And he says, my teacher, the late great psychotherapist John Weakland, one of the founders of strategic theory and co-author of the double bind theory, once told me the secret to life success was to have a project so important and so big you would find yourself accomplishing everything and putting it off. Now he's pointing out that this idea I have in structured procrastination isn't original in the sense that I was the first one to think about it. Probably Aristotle had it, although I don't think he was a procrastinator. But another person is Robert Benchley, the great humorist, who wrote an essay with the same idea. But now, Timothy, the next email is a question for you. And it's, is procrastination related in any way to other kind of self-destructive behavior like alcoholism and drug use?
Yes, in fact, they all get grouped together by most people who study self-regulation failure, like Roy Baumeister, Kathleen Vohs, and others, that obsessive gambling, compulsive shopping, overeating, they all share that common feature of giving in to feel good, that phrase you liked, which was short-term mood repair. They're all very much related. Now, the notion of addiction, I'm not addressing that. I'm just talking about the notion of self-regulation and how they all share that common feature. And I think, again, that goes back to that older notion of weakness of will. Even William James loved to talk about the drunkards, the schemers, and the deadbeats, because they implicitly there they were being grouped together in terms of this notion of obstructed will. Absolutely, they share a common feature of what it means to be human.
Well, this is getting better and better. So now I can say, look, I'm engaging in short-term mood repair, and most
yes.
people do that, drink or take drugs or gamble. So lay off the procrastination criticism.
So look, I want to...
Well, you know, it's true that it seems to be the least of the sins, although sloth, which has always been a sin, whether it be Hindu, Buddhist, Judaic, Christian, has really that it acknowledges the temporal nature of being human. Time is the most precious thing you and I have, and if we waste it, I think that's why sloth was one of the seven deadly sins.
Well, now that brings up another email, which is, isn't your guest treating procrastination as a moral issue? Is this really the right way to look at it?
Are you treating it as a moral issue?
I am. I fall directly into a camp philosophically of Mark White from the City University of New York, a Kantian economic perspective, that it is an issue. As soon as I call it a weakness of will, it becomes a moral issue. And I truly believe that it is, and it is a deeply existential issue at the same time.
Let me ask another quick kind of question, though. Look, some people argue that some of these forms of irrationality that we are so criticized, we think they're forms of irrationality because we have this a priori notion of reality. rationale. If we look at the evolved human being, we find they're actually come with adaptive advantages. Self-deception is often claimed to be adaptive. Is there any argument, evolutionary argument, that, you know, the reason we do this, mood repair kind of thing?
Short-term mood repair.
Yeah. There's some adaptive advantage to that? Is there any argument on that side?
I have not seen anything written about it, but if we think about our Stone Age brain running around in the modern world, if we think about food choices, we love sugar and fat because it was so evolutionarily advantageous. But then in our modern world, we're getting obese because of it. I think the evolutionary advantage of a bird in a hand, which was often the case for perhaps our ancestors, it doesn't play itself out the same way. And so short-term mood repair comes at a greater cost, much as eating sugars and fats does now. So I do think that we do have to look at whether it's an evolutionary byproduct or an adaptation. It doesn't work so well right now.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing procrastination with Timothy Pitchell, director of the Procrastination Research Group and author of The Procrastinator's Digest.
So what can be done about procrastination? Is there a Procrastinators Anonymous, a 12-step self-help program for procrastinators? Is there a Procrastinon, a program for those whose lives are being ruined by procrastinators?
Strategies for dealing with procrastination when Philosophy Talk continues.
Wait till tomorrow. Another way to say procrastinate. And procrastination is our topic today. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Timothy Pitchell from Carleton University. So, John, I know that you've thought a lot about this. And on your website, structuredprocrastination.com, you offer some advice. Tell us, not all of your advice, but pick out the best advice you've got.
Well, the main thing, which one of our emailers pointed out, it's for procrastinators who feel bad about themselves, and it's not to solve the procrastination, although I think it's the first step towards it. And that's don't feel too bad, because at least if you're like me, you're getting a lot done as a way of not doing the task at the top of your to-do list. I mean, what led me to write it was I was feeling terrible about being such a procrastinator, and I realized, but look, all my colleagues in the philosophy department think of me as someone who gets a lot done. Yeah. That could have been...
Which is true. You do get a lot done.
And how do I get a lot done? By not doing the things at the top of my to-do list. So that's structured procrastination.
But that means you do the second and third and fourth things.
Oh, and the fifth and sixth and seventh.
Right. So, Timothy, do you think that's a wise piece of advice or not? I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, I do. I think it's harnessing your avoidance motivation wherever you can get it. Use it, right? And so you're avoiding some task and it's fueling others. And that's a great strategy. But as John says, it requires a little bit of self-deception at the beginning, because what you put at the top of your list has to be apparently urgent and apparently important, but neither. And he says, tongue-in-cheek, as he said, that, well, you know, procrastinators are pretty good at this self-deception thing, so it'll usually work. But I think, sure, we can harness our avoidance motivation. Defensive pessimists do it all the time. They worry about the worst possible outcome, and they work like heck to make sure it doesn't happen. So we know, as human beings, we can harness our avoidance.
Philip in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Philip.
Hi, thank you. I was wondering, has Dr. Pitchell studied people who... on the opposite of folks from procrastinators, people who are like seem to have no resistance to doing the next thing? Because I'm wondering, like, because I've always read that people who are like wildly creative and make more mistakes than they, because they're doing more than people who are doing maybe something in the same field like art or writing or something. And they, I guess basically what I'm asking, what do people who seem to have no resistance, if you studied them, embrace or don't think about that procrastinators seem to have?
Philip's trying to figure out the difference between the folks who get it right and who are effortlessly active and successful. What's the difference between them and the procrastinator?
Well, I want to back up a little bit and say Philip's also saying that he's saying that these artists and stuff are always accurately identifying their delay as procrastination. And I think, for example, some people will be writers and they won't actually be having their fingers on the keyboard. And of course, then they feel like they're procrastinating. But in fact, there's all sorts of pre-writing work going on. So we have to watch again that we don't call every form of delay procrastination. But if I were to study the opposite of procrastinators, it would be highly conscientious people. That's one of the big five traits in personality. Conscientious people are dutiful, self-disciplined, and organized. And yes, we do see these people as being more successful in completing the next task on their list because they're structured in such a way that this notion of extended will, they're just cranking out widgets. They're not thinking about what should I do next. They know exactly what they're going to do next. It's on their schedule.
You used a phrase that I was actually thinking about, extended will, but used it in a way different from the way I was going to introduce it to you. Because here's something that I have come to think. We think of the will as a thing inside our head, and weakness mm-hmm. of the will is weakness of the things inside our head, right? And mm-hmm. And here's a thought that I have. But look, if we engineer, take the will inside your head, however strong or weak, engineer a set of environmental structures and incentives and all that are external to you, and that can help you not procrastinate. That's one of the things that deadlines are for. Somebody says, you must give me this paper by this or else. That's not you deciding on your own to give that paper by this time or else. It's an external thing. And it seems to me that a lot of what we need to do is engineer our volitional environment, if you will. What do you think about that thought?
Well, Joe Heath and Joel Anderson, University of Utrecht, wrote a chapter in the recent book, The Thief of Time, Philosophical Essays on Procrastination, arguing just that. And I'm in total agreement that this notion of extended will, that the social context can scaffold our ability to do things, much like I don't do calculated, very complicated math calculations in my head. I use a piece of paper. I have a tool. And we can do that to structure our will as well. But in contrast to that, Mark White would argue, but the more we rely on these prosthetics and tools, we can do it to our own detriment in that we can weaken this willpower that's like a muscle. Roy Baumeister's students have shown that.
Yeah, I'm dubious.
So we have this tension. We have this tension. It is internal and it is external. The opposite of one great truth is often another great truth, and I think this is a classic example.
You know, when I was younger, I trained myself to wake up without an alarm clock by just thinking about waking up at a certain time. And I was very proud of that, but actually, what was the big deal? So now I just use an alarm clock. And alarm clocks can be used for lots of things. When you start on your email, put the alarm clock for an hour later because you won't stop on your own. But when you hear that alarm clock, it'll break your attention, and then you'll have the power to stop.
But
I see nothing wrong with will prosthetics.
I agree with you, John, but I think I think we live in a really complicated world. We've done a show on the extended mind, how we offload a lot of our cognition onto the environment, and that modern technology enables us to do that with a vengeance, so that, you know, the internet and all that, all these external memory aids and processing aids. But here's the problem with the modern world, that a lot of this stuff that we use to offload our cognition makes the will much weaker because you've got all these distractions, right? The will needs to be focused. And
that is the argument. And the other thing, too, is that we all know this, that I can set my alarm, and when my alarm goes off, I still have an issue of that internal self-control of actually getting out of bed. Like we never can sidestep the at some point I have to exert what you internalized as will. No matter what prosthetics or tools or however scaffolding I do it, there's at one point you can't sidestep this notion of self. Although behavioral economists like to, they like to deny the sense of human agency because it's so deterministic. I think, in fact, we always come back to the issue of me recognizing my sense of agency and acting.
That's true. But let me give you an analogy. I got a bunch of sand, bags of sand to take from one place to the other. And I could say, well, I'm not very strong, but I'm going to build up my strength by carrying them myself. Or I could say, I'm
going
to put them in a wheelbarrow. Now, it still takes some will to pick up the wheelbarrow, and it takes some strength to pick up the wheelbarrow, but why not make it easier on yourself?
And you should. And I totally agree with you.
So I'm just, you know, I'm all for prosthetics of the will. We've got an email that's a little bit challenging here I want to put in here. It's from James Decker. And he says, the problem with you guys is you sound like a motivational advertisement. He doesn't think we're being philosophical enough. Then skipping over to the subject, he says, I challenge you to leave off the predictable fallacy that reason equals logic or pleasure equals good as the basis for every behavior. What about dwelling in a state of pure human free will? In fact, malaise is the human condition. Art and meditation express precisely this. please speak instead of the long history of human free will as expressed through, for example, the somebody of Oscar Wilde's day who would walk turtles on leashes in the expression of liberation.
Oh, that's
utilitarian philosophy. Well, he's got a point. Is our whole approach just kind of giving into the system?
No, it's baloney, what he was saying. Because here's the philosophically deep point that's a lot different from motivational advertising. Look, it goes back to something Tim said in passing that I think is really important here. The self, right? Because here's an important fact about the self. It's not an instantaneous thing. It's spread out over time, right? Mm-hmm. But our interests, the interest of this self, kind of rise and fall with time. And one of the things I think about procrastination is that when you're procrastinating in a moment, you're being, here's a kind of moral thing, you're being unfair to your future self because your present self isn't doing its task in bringing about the good for this whole extended thing that you are. I don't think that's motivational advertising. I think that's deep fact about the structure of human agency.
Now, before Timothy responds to that, let me just interject with one more email. And says, does the guest know about the work on intertemporal bargaining and the idea of hyperbolic discounting?
Yeah, I know you do, Tim. So what do you want to respond to in what we just said?
Well, hyperbolic discounting is a good, as Joe Heath writes, it models procrastination while it doesn't explain it. And I think that we've got to do a lot of work around the difference between the behavioral economic models and how they put value over the visceral. Even Ainsley writes about this, and in fact, we're going to paper
explain
right
that.
Now.
Okay. Explain that, value over the visceral.
Well,
that's an important...
First of all, one of you explain what's meant by hyperbolic reasoning.
Yeah, hyperbolic discounting.
Just
explain
hyperbolic
that.
Discounting.
First, explain that.
We discount future rewards. We talk about the fact that... what's in the distant is smaller, and that what is in the present is in proportionately more important and larger, and it's a balancing off of the utility. They look at doing that which has the greatest utility right now. So it involves these features. Like, it's a difficult thing to explain about the 30 seconds.
So look, if there's something that I were to be able to get now, I would enjoy it a certain amount, right? It would give me a certain amount of utiles. But the fact that I can't get it until the future makes it less valuable in my present calculations than it would be if I could get it right at this moment. That means I'll take a reward now over a reward later, where the reward later would be more valuable once I got it, but it's less valuable. Is that kind of...
Exactly. Yeah. That's right.
And is that a bad thing or a good thing?
It's a human thing. We do discount these things. We prefer the sooner, smaller reward over the longer, larger reward. But it doesn't explain procrastination very well. It does explain delay. It's a very rational thing. Like, why not? But it doesn't explain everything that we need to know about the phenomenon of procrastination.
Do you think I'm right to say that if you're procrastinating, your present self is cheating your future self? Is that reasonable?
Absolutely. In fact, I've just written blogs on all of these topics, including extended will and the future self on Psychology Today. I have a blog called Don't Delay. It's available at procrastination.ca, and I'd welcome readers to look at it because they are the philosophical debates going on in that great book, The Thief of Time.
So procrastination.ca, that's your blog, and I'm sure...
That's my website, and everything's available there, including my iTunes podcast.
Oh, so tell us about your iTunes. What do you podcast about on iTunes?
Oh, I have a podcast called I Procrastinate Podcast. I've done it since 2005, and it's really all the kind of things we're talking about week after week after week.
Man, you're a procrastinator. You're the god of procrastination. You were exactly the right guest for us to get for this show.
Can you give us and our listeners a couple of tips on overcoming procrastination before we have to say goodbye?
Yeah, really quickly. Your 1 minute advice here. 1 minute
of
pure advice.
Okay, the first one is I kind of agree with Mark White, which is just try harder, which is that internal notion of will. But for me, it's just get started. You know, the journey of 1,000 miles begins with that single step. And we even heard it in the students you interviewed at the outset of this program, that once they get started, they wonder, why didn't I start earlier? It's not so bad. We know that for a fact. The other is have an implementation intention. A weekly held goal intention about what you want to accomplish is not nearly as effective as what Peter Galwitzer calls an implementation intention. If the situation is this, then I do that. I put the signal, the trigger for my behavior, it has to do with the notion of extended will in some ways. I put a trigger for my action in the environment, and it helps break habits because I've made a pre-decision to act. It's much like using the alarm clock in a sense. I no longer have to think. I've made a pre-decision to act. It'll make a big difference to use implementation intentions.
So on that note, Mark, I'm going to thank you. Tim, I'm going to thank you for joining us. You just mentioned somebody named Mark. Tim, I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been a really proactive conversation, and we've really loved having you.
I've enjoyed being with you. Thank you.
Our guest has been Timothy Pitchell. He's the director of the Procrastination Research Group at Carleton University. He's the author of The Procrastinator's Digest, a concise guide to solving the procrastination puzzle. And you can find out a lot more at his website, procrastination.ca. So, John, I know you've thought a lot about this topic. Did this conversation change your thinking, deepen your thinking in any way?
Well, Timothy Pitchell is terrific. I was a co-guest on a radio show with him once before and found out that he not only writes well, he's really a terrific radio guest. However, deep in my heart, I don't think he knows procrastination from the inside in the way that I do. He sounds like an accomplisher. I bet his desk is not a mess either. I'm not sure.
Well, you think you have to live procrastination in order to research procrastination?
No.
He's looking at all those procrastinators as strange subjects.
You don't have to be an ant to learn a lot about ants. So I'm just saying that it is an additional dimension I bring to the problem.
I can't decide about myself whether I'm a procrastinator or not, because I am definitely overcommitted.
Well, you don't need to decide right away.
And the structure of my commitments sometimes prevents me from getting the larger things that I want done. But then I say, that's something I did to myself. But you know what? This conversation, and that may be procrastination, making yourself overcommitted. This conversation continues on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo. I think, therefore, I blog. And you can find out more about us by visiting a very, very active Facebook page where we have thousands and thousands of fans and more coming every single day.
And you can sign up to get the free weekly podcast of Philosophy Talk at our website, philosophytalk.org. Don't procrastinate. Get on your computer and do that right away. For the final word, we're going to give a few seconds more for Ian Scholes, the 60-second procrastinating philosopher.
Ian Scholes, decisiveness is a two-edged sword. Fortune favors the brave, and yet fools rush in. If you act boldly, are you brave or a fool? Life-altering decisions, if my life is any indication, never alter life the way you think they will. Take Custer. If he'd procrastinated, he might have decided maybe it's not a good idea to track a few thousand angry Indians with a force less than 200. Or take the Alamo. If the defenders of the Alamo had been proactive, they might have decided, you know what, Texas isn't worth the aggro. Let's just surrender. We're encouraged to be proactive rather than reactive, but we're only human. Why pay fire insurance for something that might not even happen? Where's the fun in that? It's so much more fun to watch brave firefighters dash in and out of the flames. Remember Goofus and Gallant from the old Highlights magazine? Used to read it in the dentist's office where I'd end up with a cavity or two because I'd procrastinated on my checkup. Gallant always did everything right, wound up getting the job done. Goofus always took the easy way out and wound up messing things up. I found Gallant to be an insufferable prig and identified heavily with Goofus. Plus, it seemed to me in the real world, Goofus is the one that actually succeeds in life. Say a teacher assigns an essay due at the end of the semester. Gallant will be proactive and diligent, writing the essay in a week and turning it in months ahead of time. What's the teacher going to think? Oh, thanks, little responsible butt-kisser. Now I have to lug this essay around for 2 months. There's already resentment and a prejudice against Gallant. How good can this essay be if it only took a week to write it? Goofus, however, will dash into class with his essay a day after it was due, haggard, out of breath, dropping on the teacher's desk before collapsing on the floor. Goofus will have put much less work into his essay, but will have presented the illusion that he sweat, blood, and brain cells writing it. Teachers like that. Plus, the longer it takes a student to turn in a paper, the longer teachers can put off grading it. Win-win. Poor activity actually leads to procrastination. If you want to fireproof your office building, say, you need to figure out where to get permits. You want to get the best contractor. That means research, committees, feasibility studies, lawyers, PowerPoint demonstrations. How will this impact your employees? You need feedback from them, and they'll use the opportunity to air grudges and grievances that have nothing to do with the project. This can take years. In the meantime, some disgruntled employee will torch the building, and you'll wind up in the parking lot watching the brave firefighters dash in and out of the flames. So it just goes to show you, trying to make money is a bad idea. That's why I procrastinated for years in pursuing a fabulous show business career. Luckily today, I'm in public radio, and I'm wealthy beyond an emperor's dreams. Put it off. It'll all work out. I gotta go.
The Wisdom of the Ages, in a nutshell, from Ian Scholes, the 60-Second Philosopher.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2011.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Our directors of research are Daniel Elstein and Ben Hirsch. Leah Weiss is our webmaster.
And special thanks to Chris Hoff, Merle Kessler, Corey Goldman, Dave Millar, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University. The Friends of Philosophy Talk,
and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Skyline of my hometown, New Orleans. It was a great place to grow up, but it's one of the most vulnerable spots in the world. Half the city is already below sea level. In 2005, the world watched as New Orleans and the Gulf Coast were devastated by Hurricane Katrina. 1,836 people died. Nearly 300,000 homes were lost. These are my mother's at the top, although that's not her car. It was carried there by floodwaters up to the roof. And that's my sister's below. Fortunately, they and other family members got out in time, but they lost their homes, and as you can see, just about everything in them. Other parts of the world have been hit by storms in even more devastating ways. In 2008, Cyclone Nargis and its aftermath killed 138,000 in Myanmar. Climate change is affecting our homes, our communities, our way of life. We should be preparing at every scale and at every opportunity. This talk is about being prepared for and resilient to the changes that are coming and that will affect our homes and our collective home, the Earth. The changes in these times won't affect us all equally. There are important distributional consequences, and they're not what you always might think. In New Orleans, the elderly and female-headed households were among the most vulnerable. For those in vulnerable low-lying nations, how do you put a dollar value on losing your country where your ancestors are buried? And where will your people go? And how will they cope in a foreign land? Will there be tensions over immigration or conflicts over competition for limited resources? It's already fueled conflicts in Chad and Darfur. Like it or not, ready or not, this is our future. Sure, some are looking for opportunities in this new world. That's the Russians planting a flag on the ocean bottom to stake a claim for minerals under the receding Arctic sea ice. But while there might be some short-term individual winners, our collective losses will far outweigh them. Look no further than the insurance industry as they struggle to cope with mounting catastrophic losses from extreme weather events. The military gets it. They call climate change a threat multiplier that could harm stability and security, while governments around the world are evaluating how to respond. So what can we do? How can we prepare and adapt? I'd like to share three sets of examples, starting with adapting to violent storms and floods. In New Orleans, the I-10 twin spans, with sections knocked out in Katrina, have been rebuilt 21 feet higher to allow for greater storm surge. And these raised and energy-efficient homes were developed by Brad Pitt and make it right for the hard-hit Ninth Ward. The devastated church my mom attends has been not only rebuilt higher, it's poised to become the first Energy Star church in the country. They're selling electricity back to the grid thanks to solar panels, reflective paint, and more. Their March electricity bill was only $48. Now, these are examples of New Orleans rebuilding in this way, but better if others act proactively with these changes in mind. For example, in Galveston, here's a resilient home that survived Hurricane Ike when others on neighboring lots clearly did not. And around the world, satellites and warning systems are saving lives in flood-prone areas such as Bangladesh. But as important as technology and infrastructure are, perhaps the human element is even more critical. We need better planning and systems for evacuation. We need to better understand how people make decisions in times of crisis and why. While it's true that many who died in Katrina did not have access to transportation, others who did refused to leave as the storm approached, often because available transportation and shelters refused to allow them to take their pets. Imagine leaving behind your own pet in an evacuation or a rescue. Fortunately, in 2006, Congress passed the Pet Evacuation and Transportation Standards Act. It spells pets to change that. Second, preparing for heat and drought. Farmers are facing challenges of drought from Asia to Africa, from Australia to Oklahoma, while heat waves linked with climate change have killed tens of thousands of people in Western Europe in 2003 and again in Russia in 2010. In Ethiopia, 70%, that's 70% of the population, depends on rainfall for its livelihood. Oxfam and Swiss Re, together with Rockefeller Foundation, are helping farmers like this one build hillside terraces and find other ways to conserve water. But they're also providing for insurance when the droughts do come. The stability this provides is giving the farmers the confidence to invest. It's giving them access to affordable credit. It's allowing them to become more productive so that they can afford their own insurance over time without assistance. It's a virtuous cycle and one that could be replicated throughout the developing world. After a lethal 1995 heat wave turned refrigerator trucks from the popular Taste of Chicago festival into makeshift morgues, Chicago became a recognized leader, tamping down on the urban heat island impact through opening cooling centers, outreach to vulnerable neighborhoods, planting trees, creating cool white or vegetated green roofs. This is City Hall's green roof next to Cook County's roof, which is 77 degrees Fahrenheit hotter at the surface. Washington, D.C., last year, actually led the nation in new green roofs installed. And they're funding this in part thanks to a 5-cent tax on plastic bags. They're splitting the cost of installing these green roofs with home and building owners. The roofs not only temper urban heat island impact, but they save energy and therefore money, the emissions that cause climate change, and they also reduce stormwater runoff. So some solutions to heat can provide for win-win-wins. Third, adapting to rising seas. Sea level rise threatens coastal ecosystems, agriculture, even major cities. This is what 1 to 2 meters of sea level rise looks like in the Mekong Delta. That's where half of Vietnam's rice is grown. Infrastructure is going to be affected. Airports around the world are located on the coast. It makes sense, right? There's open space. The planes can take off and land without worrying about creating noise or avoiding tall buildings. Here's just one example, San Francisco Airport, with 16 inches or more of flooding. Imagine the staggering cost of protecting this vital infrastructure with levees. But there might be some changes in store that you might not imagine. For example, planes require more runway for takeoff because the heated, less dense air provides for less lift. San Francisco is also spending $40 million to rethink and redesign its water and sewage treatment, as water outfall pipes like this one can be flooded with seawater, causing backups at the plant, harming the bacteria that are needed to treat the waste. So these outfall pipes have been retrofitted to shut seawater off from entering the system. Beyond these technical solutions, our work at the Georgetown Climate Center with communities encourages them to look at what existing legal and policy tools are available and to consider how they can accommodate change. For example, in land use, which areas do you want to protect through adding a seawall, for example, alter by raising buildings, or retreat from to allow the migration of important natural systems, such as wetlands or beaches. Other examples to consider. In the UK, the Thames Barrier protects London from storm surge. The Asian City's Climate Resilience Network is restoring vital ecosystems like forest mangroves. These are not only important ecosystems in their own right, but they also serve as a buffer to protect inland communities. New York City is incredibly vulnerable to storms, as you can see from this clever sign, and to sea level rise and to storm surge, as you can see from the subway flooding. But back above ground, these raised ventilation grates for the subway system show that solutions can be both functional and attractive. In fact, in New York, San Francisco, and London, designers have envisioned ways to better integrate the natural and built environments with climate change in mind. I think these are inspiring examples of what's possible when we feel empowered to plan for a world that will be different. But now, a word of caution. Adaptation is too important to be left to the experts. Why? Well, there are no experts. We're entering uncharted territory, and yet our expertise